Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
On today's show, we'll be celebrating cult classic film They Live with designer and book publisher Craig Odom. He'll be explaining why John Carpenter's offbeat 80s sci-fi serves as a razor-sharp comment piece on consumerism and more.
We'll also be hearing from Lisa O'Neill, the singer whose album Heard a Long Gone Song is revitalizing the folk tradition for our times.
And we'll be questioning the nature of time itself with Grace Weir. The artist will be discussing her new work, now on show at London's Gallery at the Institute of Physics.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Paige Reynolds will be looking ahead to the next 7 days in news, and we'll enjoy some more music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Another week, another weekly. Fernando, great to have you back in the chair. And actually, this is the first full week you've been back in the UK. You took a somehow authorised, incredibly long, a seasonal vacation back in Brazil. I must say you look very good on it, but it must have been a bit of a shock to the system. It's cold here in London.
It's very cold. I mean, it's almost snowing here in London. And to me, this is the first week of 2019, in my opinion. For many Brazilians, it isn't, Tom, because, as you know, Brazilians, their year only starts after Carnival, so only the beginning of March.
Are the Brazilians a bit more optimistic despite Bolsonaro there? What's the view?
They are. It's a mixture of chaos with optimism, which is something quite Brazilian, in my opinion. So I think it's early days. People are optimistic, but there's been quite a lot of problems already in the government. Some, you know, Bolsonaro says something and the minister said another thing.
And then you arrive here in the UK. We've got chaos.
Oh, yeah.
We've got chaos and pessimism.
God.
So it's the worst of both worlds. Anyway, enough about that.
Chaos everywhere.
Let's cheer ourselves with an absolutely sensational programme which lies ahead. And we're going to set the bar pretty high from the get-go. Let's welcome in Paige Reynolds. Everybody's talking. Welcome, Paige. There may be some front page news. There may be something more from the feature spreads. What have you got for us?
Well, I think most of us this week in the news team have sort of been drowning in Brexit. So we won't look at that.
Instead, that is a relief.
Good relief, indeed. Instead, actually, we're going to look a little further east. Shinzo Abe is planning to meet Putin in Moscow on Tuesday over this territorial dispute that we've been following for a while now. So this is over these Pacific islands, which in Russia are known as the Southern Kurils and in Japan are known as the Northern Territories. And since the end of World War II, these islands, these Pacific islands, have basically been in limbo. And Japan and Russia, from November, have decided that they now need a peace treaty on what to do with these islands. But it's very complicated. So they signed a declaration in 1956, which said that the Soviet Union would give back two of these islands. But then in 1960, the Soviet Union revoked this sort of decision, and because Japan signed a treaty with the United States. So it's all sort of suddenly coming up again. And I guess the questions are, you know, why are they sort of solving this dispute now? And I guess what's going to happen? I mean, Sergei Lavrov met his Japanese counterpart this week, and they're at loggerheads. There weren't any sort of progress made there. So interesting. We'll see what happens.
And one imagines that for maybe both of these men, it's a chance to play the sort of the statesman on the global stage, maybe get them away from some problems on the home front. Never a bad thing, is it, to be seen to be doing big statesman-like work, maybe when your poll ratings are not heading in the right direction?
Yeah, certainly. I think Abe and Putin are both sort of haven't had the best of years for polling, so they'll be trying to get that back up.
And Paige, your second story is about something I think I understand a bit more, which is cinema, right? Tell us a bit more.
Indeed, indeed. So although the Oscar nominations are out this week, the Sundance Film Festival actually starts on Friday. So this is the first incarnation of the festival since Robert Redford actually retired from the screen. So his last film was The Old Man and the Gun. And actually, for anyone interested, Monocle's Ben Ryland actually spoke with the director of this film, David Larry, on a previous edition of The Weekly. So tune back in after this one. And, you know, I think this festival has always been known for sort of emerging talent, for sort of really pushing underrepresented voices in the film industry. And this year it looks to be, you know, no different. They've got 241 projects from 49 different countries. 47% of these are projects directed or created by women. 41% were directed or created by filmmakers of colour. And 17% are from people who identify as LGBT. So they've they've got a lot of underrepresented voices who are able to sort of tell stories. And I think it's, you know, it's a great festival.
And Paige, it's interesting you mentioned the Oscars, because I think even the people that vote in the Oscars, they keep an eye on Sundance, because what you see in Sundance now might be nominated for next year's Oscars, actually, because they can be quite influential, right?
For sure. This year's crop features Joanna Hogg's mystery, The Souvenir, starring Tilda Swinton, Babak Anvari's Under the Shadow follow-up Wounds, and Chiwetel Ejiofor's first feature directing debut, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. And they're also playing The Blair Witch Project, which first debuted at Sundance 20 years ago in 1999.
Great film.
That makes me feel incredibly old. So let's move
That's
on.
That's what I always try to do, Tom.
What have you got? There must be something slightly madcap, harebrained, happening somewhere in the world. What's caught your eye, Paige,
this
week?
There is indeed. So my final story is a little bit rogue. It's the annual Arctic Frontiers Conference in Norway next week. And to my surprise, when I looked into this, these Arctic Frontier Conferences aren't anything new. They've been going on since 2006. And this is the 13th edition. And they're essentially there to sort of set the agenda and link sort of policy, business, and science interests in that sort of realm. But I think it's interesting because, you know, with climate change increasingly becoming a really huge political consideration, the dialogues had here might sort of bleed into more of a sort of worldwide geopolitical future. So, you know, the Arctic is this new frontier. It feels very far away, but it's somewhere that, you know, a lot of countries are looking to expand its influence. To go back to Russia, we saw last year, Russia was sort of working towards reasserting its military presence in the Arctic frontier and trying to secure access to this northern shipping corridor, the Northern Sea Route. So that's going to be discussed. And they've got some really varied speakers for all their sessions. You've got government ministers from Norway and Finland, the Alaskan senator, Canadian representatives, the leader of the Norwegian Ice Service, some actual explorers, mayors, businessmen, the CEO of an Arctic tourist cruise company. So I think this sort of cross-disciplinary approach on trying to sort of work out what's going on in that sphere might be quite interesting and might actually bleed into what's happening in warmer climates.
Paige Reynolds, thanks for joining us as always. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Do stay with us. We'll be talking to the designer Craig Oldham in just a moment.
Released in 1988, John Carpenter's cult classic film, They Live, follows a drifter, played by professional wrestler Rowdy Roddy Piper, whose world is turned upside down by the discovery of a pair of magic sunglasses. If it sounds nutty, that's because it is. A scathing critique of unrestrained capitalism within the trappings of a trashy B-movie. The shades reveal unsettling X-ray-like visions of the world, from the motives of the man in the street to the hidden messages found in advertising. But the success with which They Live delivers its subversive message means it now assumes an influential position in popular culture. From Shepard Fairey with his Obey campaign to the work of philosopher Slavoj Žižek, the film has informed many a creative mind over the past three decades.
Now the designer Craig Oldham's putting it under the spotlight with a new publication, a replica of a magazine that appears in the film. The book offers an invaluable insight into They Live and its relevance today, as well as a showcase of outstanding graphic design, which we like. And Craig, I'm happy to say, joins us now. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Craig. Good to have you with us. Let me start off by asking about the big concept of taking things from fiction and making them real. There's something completely compelling about that, and this has certainly got people in our offices talking. Everyone who comes over says, oh, is that from They Live? Is that a long-held fancy of yours? I know it's part of a sort of a big project, isn't it, really?
It is, yeah. I'm glad you said that, because I thought I was the only one. You always have those dangers when you're sort of doing projects like this. But, yeah, essentially the idea, it wasn't necessarily just for the They Live book. It was for a series of books called the Epiphany Editions, where I was always really interested in how film sort of draws on culture to make itself, and then after the film is made, when it releases itself to the world and then has its own mark on culture in a kind of similar way. And I really wanted to sort of find a vehicle or a technology to sort of encapsulate that, and the book seemed the perfect thing because I could take one directly from these films, and there's a whole list of them, and it is one of those things that once you start thinking about it, you remember loads and you fall down the rabbit hole. But yeah. They Live was definitely one of those. I love the film. I think it's a really, really interesting example of drawing from cultural times and drawing from a political climate and then going out and having its own sort of impact in various different things. So I was really chuffed when we could get that one moving, really.
I was going to ask, actually, Craig, what was your first experience with They Live? I mean, I guess you were not around when the film was released.
I wasn't. I was 3 years old when the film was released. But I've always been a bit of a fan of Carpenter's work. I think Escape from New York was probably the first film I saw of Carpenter. At a time when I was sort of hammering my PlayStation, playing Metal Gear Solid and seeing this kind of symmetry between, you know, Snake Plissken in the film and Solid Snake in the game, and that little flag just sort of raising and going, oh yeah, right, okay, that's what it comes from. And then, of course, started to just exhaust all the other films he'd done. But it was actually a friend of mine called Matt, who I work with at an agency, another designer, and he knew I liked Carpenter, and I think I was waffling on about a film one day about Carpenter. He said, oh, have you seen They Live? And I was like, I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it. The next day he came with a sort of bootlegged DVD of it, you know, scribbled on the front, watch this. And I did, and it just blew my mind. And it was almost like I'd seen the film without seeing the film, because I got all the references from other things, and it just sort of flooded in. I mean, obviously, I used to love wrestling as well when I was a kid. So I knew Roddy Piper, and it just all just came in and Obey and all of that kind of stuff. So it was a real joining of the dots, and since then it's really, really grown on me. It probably is my favourite now, although it wasn't at the first, you know, instance.
Well, and maybe that speaks to how clever it was. I just wondered, because there's a sort of a weird meta quality to all of this, and post-modern, where we have books from films which are themselves about ad hoardings and all the rest of it. Do you think that Carpenter, I mean, he has a great reputation and he has real aficionados and his fans are really committed, but is he still sort of underrated in terms of, I mean, you look at this film now and it feels super relevant today. Was he, I don't know, he was a director and a general sort of polymath who was a kind of ahead of his time in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of his films were ahead of the curve when they were released. A lot of people put him in that kind of cult status because I guess when the films are released, they generally don't do very well in terms of the kind of movie blockbuster standards that we've become accustomed to. They don't sell out and straight away, and they don't just sort of smash number one for weeks kind of thing. But I think that is not because the films, I don't think that's a remark on in any way on their quality or what they're talking about or what the actual films have done in terms of craft. I think it's just because his films generally are ahead of the curve. And I think They Live is a real testament to that, because it does a really rare thing that, I mean, I love it when films do it, and it is unbelievably one of the things I love so much about films is it is of its time, and it's really political, and it's really, it deals with some really, really big grand ideas that you'd think a film can never really solve. Yeah, it can also just entertain you for 90 minutes of pure 80s sci-fi action, you know. And I think that it's easy, they said, but it's actually a really hard thing to do in film. But Carpenter seems to do it really well with a lot of his films. He embeds subplots and ideas of all kinds of things that we're still sort of grappling with now, particularly, for example, sort of the gender imbalance. You know, his reputation exceeds that he always tries to put strong female leads in his films, or he has strong female characters that really just don't take any shit from anybody, and they go away and they crusade on their own. And that is really rare back then, and it's still, you know, it's still something that we're grappling with today. So it does make these themes sort of come through, and people unpick them, and it makes them really relevant now.
Another thing that's very relevant in Carpenter's films is the aesthetics as well, which is just absolutely amazing. And that's why perhaps also reading your books quite interesting. You know, all the posters, they were amazing for They Live as well, the soundscapes as well.
I think, yeah, I think he's a beautiful director. His films look great. They're brilliantly edited. The scene in They Live, for example, when the sunglasses first go on and we see through the sunglasses for the first time, that is an absolute masterclass in editing on Hitchcock levels, which he used to call it assembly. It's not editing, it's not cutting, it's assembly. We're assembling an idea together. And I think that's what Carpenter is really, really good at, that storytelling element. And I think that's another virtue of him. Although his films do look beautiful, I don't think he sets out to make them beautiful. He sets out to tell a really good story in the best way he can with the limited means that he has. And that seems to sort of bring about this aesthetic of independent film, but they'd look beautiful, and that I think that is because he's almost a slave to the story.
Craig, let me ask you a bit about then craft. We talked a lot about Carpenter's craft. What about your craft as a sort of graphic artist? Increasingly, and a lot of the people we talked to, thinking about, you know, we spoke to Adele Rodriguez with his amazing Trump illustrations, and now the illustrator, the graphic artist, wields a lot of quite political power, and you've already talked about the politics of Carpenter. He's quite ahead of the times. These days, there's so much media, we know, everyone's barraged with images, but the very capable graphic artist wields considerable power. Is that something that sits very comfortably with you? Do you like the fact that people maybe rely more on an impactful image, a single shot, a moment to really make a point now, perhaps because people are, you know, they're time poor or they don't have the patience to read something. Do you like that? Does it interest you to be sort of political with your craft, or do you just want people to judge it for what it is?
I think for me personally, I think the craft element and the sort of the visual nature of graphic design or graphic art or illustration or image making in any kind of form, for me, I think it has to be personal and it has to be meaningful first and foremost. And I think how then it comes across as an image or as an illustration or as a piece of typography or whatever is after the fact. I think you have to sort of really embed that message and get that message right and clear and proper. The communication has to come first. And then I think you dress it up after the fact, really. That, for me, is the most important thing. What do I care about and how do I want to share that with people? And hopefully the right way, the right form will then present itself after that once I know what I'm trying to do properly.
If you're, say, designing or working on something that's going to be in a book, or if it's going to be a campaign, or it's you know that it's going to be for digital, do you switch gears in your head then? I sense from what you say that, no, you just focus on the work and its merit and the truth you're trying to express, and you worry about even the platform later? Or do you have to be mindful of the medium as well as the message, if you like?
Yeah, I think in the most basic terms, I always think, what am I trying to achieve and what is the best way to achieve that? And in that order, because in the commercial landscape, you're given briefs, you're almost, it's almost stipulated what they want from you. We need a new logo, we need a website, we need this, we need that. But actually, if you interrogate those things a little bit more, it's more important to figure out, well, why do they think that they need a new logo or website or whatever? And that's the thing I always try to address, because I think you get to a more meaningful level with your work then. I think you are able then to really sort of move into an intellectual discipline rather than a visual one. And I think that is really important for me personally, because I think you just create meaningful work that actually then does what you want it to do and sticks, rather than becomes a bit of a fashion or a vogue.
Craig, I just want to come back to the film a little bit. I was curious about his choice of the main character, you know, with the wrestler, which you said you were quite a fan. Why did he choose him? Do you think he was trying to say something about masculinity as well, because of the fact that he was a wrestler and everything?
I think so. I think my reading of it is that, certainly from sort of watching interviews that were done of John Carpenter at the time where he talks about the film and sort of since, I seem to detect the tone that he was really frustrated with how the, particularly the 1980s and Hollywood was portraying the idea of the hero. We've already sort of mentioned that he always puts strong female characters in his films, and there is one in They Live, which I'll get to in a sec. But essentially, I think he was really frustrated with that idea of your Arnold Schwarzeneggers, your Sylvester Stallones, your Jean-Claude Van Damme's. In the 80s, that kind of triumvirate of men were just invincible. Even in the films they starred in, they came from sort of well-to-do backgrounds. They were all army colonels or this or that or the other, and they'd just be invincible. They'd punch someone, they'd never get up. They'd shoot them, they'd never get... That was it. And they'd just sort of breeze through their films with this air of invincibility. And I think that really annoyed John Carpenter. I think he didn't see humanity in that. He didn't see real life. And I think when he met Roddy Piper, which, as legend has it, they met at WrestleMania 3, he sort of liked the fact that when they got talking that Roddy Piper had actually, you know, been homeless as a kid in Canada, grown up on the streets as a teenager, and then literally had to fight his way into a fighting career the hard way, doing a lot of brawls and a lot of sort of boxing before he became a professional wrestler. So I think, in my view, he's trying to sort of send up that idea that he wanted someone with a bit of street in them, with a bit of grit, that wasn't invincible. And if you watch the film, he doesn't breeze through it. He is the action hero, and, you know, he does get in fights and he does shoot a massive gun, but he limps all the way through the film. He gets beaten up and outsmarted by everybody in the film. And where the female character comes in, played by Meg Foster, you see in that film, a lot of people critique Meg Foster's character as kind of useless. They think that she's there to sort of be a love interest in the classic kind of 80s action hero thing. Something that the hero has to save, or a reward for saving the day kind of thing. There's the girl. Again, I don't think he liked that. And if you actually really study, in my opinion, if you study the character of Meg Foster, she just completely outsmarts him, outdoes him. She smashes his head with a bottle and throws him out the window. And then in the end, of course, at the climax, she's involved in that as well. And I think that is a whole send-up of hypermasculinity in 80s films, and that role of, why does the man always have to be the hero? I think that's really important to John Carpenter, and I think it really does play well in that film.
Craig, we started off by talking about the sort of the relevance, if you like, of the film and of this piece that you've created around it for today. Do you ever worry that other people will cotton onto that? And rather than just celebrating the film and Carpenter's work or looking at books like you've produced, they'll say, oh, I know, time for a reboot. Let's make, you know, the commentary on 2019, the film that Carpenter would make today if he was starting afresh. Does that worry you? Are you one of those people that sort of thinks, oh, look, you know, don't mess with it. I've got a sort of respect for it. It needs to stand alone. Or do you think it would be interesting to see, I don't know, a contemporary director or someone else, I don't know, having another bash at this film for today? What do you think about that?
I think if someone were to sort of try and reboot They Live, I think they'd have a really hard job. I think the film in and of itself, it's by no means perfect, but the story of it and the way that the story is told is really, really watertight in terms of the question. Equally, I'm not quite sure what the update would be, other than a technological aspect, perhaps. But again, that to me feels a really sort of surface view of things. When it comes to today and the sort of climate we're in, it's still the same, I think. The issues that are addressed in They Live 30 years ago are still pertinent now. The only thing that's different for me is that actually we don't bother to hide it from people anymore. Yeah. I think we're so brash about things, and in a world of alternative facts and fake news and known unknowns and all these other kind of political isms and ists, that they just don't bother hiding it from us anymore. So I think that would be a challenge in and of itself, because it wouldn't be believable. They're just so brash about it in the sort of Trump May world that we live in.
Yeah, it would almost be a question of taking the metaphorical glasses off and seeing what lies behind. I must ask Craig as well, you mentioned Epiphany Editions. Tell us about, and you said there's almost too many things, you sort of open a can of worms. Do you know what's next? Have you already got a shortlist? How will that work? What's the time frame? We are hungry to hear what might be next in your crosshairs.
Well, yeah, the Epiphany Editions, like I said, that was the start of this whole project, this whole thing. And I think with They Live starting, that has kind of given us a model that we do want to follow in terms of the structure of the books. We want to involve cultural figures that have had some involvement in the film or taken inspiration from it and give it a richer interpretation and a richer understanding of that film now. But yes, there is a shortlist. It's almost added to on a daily basis. So when I see a film and I see one, I spot one, it's like, oh, and then I get absolutely obsessed with it. I think The Shining will probably be the next one, wow, which will be, again, a replica of the manuscript. So it'll be unbound and in a box. Because again, the epiphany in that film, particularly from the female lead in that with Shelley Duvall, that is the moment where it's the catalyst in the entire film. She's putting it off and pretending everything's okay whilst Jack's character is completely sort of in meltdown in his own kind of world. That's the point when she realises, oh shit, he's gone nuts, when she's reading through the manuscript. So that is definitely one that we're pursuing at the moment and that we're quite far down the line with, and hopefully will be the next one. And then there's a whole other raft of films that we want to explore. And I want to sort of say that it isn't just we want to do cult horror sci-fi kind of things. They just happen to be very rich tropes. You know, there's always a bloody book in a horror film. You know, it's one of those things. We want to do more kind of popular films, I guess. We want to do all kinds of genres, because it's about the way that those films find an audience and embed themselves in an audience and then almost give them something back for that. And not be snobbish about it, you know. All films can be enjoyed by anyone, and everybody has films that they probably don't tell other people that they watch, even though they love them. So it's about that. Again, it's that nerd thing. But yes, there is a whole big list, and the idea is to do at least 3 to 5 of them and then see where we are with it. Again, like I said, mix, rich and varied diet of films, really.
Well, it's a wonderful project, and well, I already can't wait to hear about the next one. Do you pledge to return and tell us once it's completed? I don't know when that will be. How long does this take? How long's
well,
a piece of string, right?
I mean, yeah, now that we've got that one out, there's definite momentum. I've kind of got the bug and I want to do more. And I, like I said, the Shining book is quite far down the line in terms of pulling that material together and knowing how it's going to look, feel, be, etc.
Smell, even.
Smell, yes.
Yeah, because I was going to ask, I mean, if the listeners buy your book, they will smell a little bit of a bubble gun.
They will. It is printed with a scent, which essentially is almost like a water-based ink that you can't see but does have a scent embedded in it. And you just have to activate it by sort of either pulling it out of the slipcase if you've got the limited edition, or by thumbing through the book, essentially, and you will get a strange whiff of bubblegum.
You see, I said it's meta. That's
which,
what I
yeah,
said.
Yeah, which again comes
we
from the film.
It's multi-platform meta something, I don't know. Craig, it's a fantastic project. This edition is fabulous. We can't wait for the next ones. Tell our listeners where they can find out more, pick up copies.
You can pick up copies online at roughtradebooks.com, and there will be screenings all over the place in the future and exhibitions of the material from the book that will be roaming around the country.
Fantastic. Craig, it's great to speak with you. Thanks for coming to see us.
Thank you very much.
And Tom, as usual, it's time for some music. Are you ready?
Absolutely. What have you got for me, Fernando?
We'll be hearing from singer Lisa O'Neill in a moment. This is from her recent album, Heard a Long Gone Song, and the song is called Rock the Machine.
I'm losing will. My hands are soft as cotton gloves. Machine has eaten up my job. My meaning, my cause. Bore up the machine until it dies. River rock the machine down on the dock. River rock until it stops.
Lisa O'Neill there with Rock the Machine. And O'Neill's fourth album, Heard a Long Gone Song, from which that track came out towards the end of last year, quickly making its way onto a number of Best of 2018 lists. Combining traditional folk songs alongside her own heartfelt compositions, its raw and stripped-back sound and Lisa's uncompromising vocals make it an arresting and essential listen for both folkies and non-folkies alike.
With a number of shows across Ireland, the UK and Germany on the horizon, Monaco's Augustine Macellari recently caught up with her to learn more about how the album came together and the complexities of capturing a live tradition on record.
I think people can be kind of a bit cagey about folk music because it comes with this sort of network of associations that aren't all positive. You know, people might think that it's twee or that there's some kind of novelty aspect to it, but your album seems to be very firmly rooted in this kind of, I hesitate to call it a new school because I suspect it's always been there, but people are only just, maybe the wider music audience is only just waking up to it, but it's part of a really strong and assertive folk sound that unambiguously embraces tradition at the same time as being very contemporary. I just wanted to ask about how you arrived at this place where you were tackling these traditional songs in a way that is so timeless?
Well, I wouldn't see it as tackling them. I mean, they've just been songs that I've been aware of over the years and have loved. And aside from doing my own thing, I released three albums prior to the recent one, which were completely original. I have many influences, and one of those influences would be traditional songs and folk music. So they were in there, aside from performing my own songs over the years. Around Ireland and outside Ireland, I've been always kept my kind of foot in the water of the traditional and folk sessions. So I've been singing those songs over the years, you know, and when I decided to make an album where I would finally record some of them, I chose my favourite ones.
The way the album is balanced, it's seamless and consistent across all the songs. There's not a kind of one isn't struck that this sounds different than any of the others. And I kind of wanted to ask about how you, when you're writing, how traditional songs inform your approach and how you kind of write against this other interest.
I think that everything that I listen to somehow informs the approach. A lot of the traditional songs are written so well. Some of them are very literal and some of them are not. I guess that's gone in somehow. Some of the original songs that I wrote topically go back before I was born. I've tried to stay kind of loyal, in a sense, to their time. And the original songs that I wrote are quite stripped down as well, and as the traditional songs that I recorded are too. So I wanted to make an album that didn't, like you say, that nothing stands out strangely on it. It's different to the records that I made before.
As you say, the songs that you wrote are set in their time. I mean, Violet Gibson, which tells the story of an Irish lady who travelled to Italy in, was it the early 30s or the 20s, to kill Mussolini.
I go out to Rome with a rock in my fist and a gun in my bag, and I shoot Mussolini in the nose.
It has a lot of parallels, right, with the kind of current climate. Was that something that you were mindful of as you were writing it?
From my perspective, looking back into a little bit of history, I think that just that in itself makes it current. The chords that I chose to write these songs are so basic, and so more of my focus would have been on the lyric, the story. And the traditional songs that I chose to put on this album, I chose quite a simple approach in the chords as well. That all makes it, you know, it makes them family-like.
I wanted to ask about that. So when it comes to arranging a traditional song, it makes sense that you're sort of looking to draw a kind of contiguous sound across the album. How much do you worry about changing it, taking an original kind of swipe at it? And how much are you interested in kind of preserving it in as kind of close to a traditional way as possible?
I chose to learn versions that I liked the most. And I don't think I like to think I didn't go too far from those versions. The Lass of Ockham, for example, is so simple. I didn't go too far from that. The Galway Shawl, again, I learned Margaret Barry's version, and you're going to hear me in there, but I didn't go too far from her version either, which is my favourite. Factory Girl, myself and Rady, we worked that one out together, but she had more of an input in the choice of harmonies. But again, we took that from two versions that we loved, one being a woman called Nellie Weldon, and again, the second version that we studied, I guess, or soaked up, would have been Margaret Barry's version again. And the fourth song that is not mine on the album is Shane McGowan's song, and I tried to stay close enough to his version too. As far as staying close to the tradition, melodically, they're not far off, originals, and we haven't changed any words. So I believe that I have stayed loyal enough to that. But I'm not going to take credit for being well-versed or a virtuosus in the traditional song. That hasn't been my core strength over the years. It's just another wonderful influence.
To go back to The Factory Girl that you sing and Rady Pete from Lancome joins you on, I think that's one of the most striking songs on the album. I have to say, when I first heard it, it kind of made the hairs on my arm stand on end.
A bright look of disdain. Young man of manners, and do not insult me.
It showcases your vocals, which across the album are, again, striking. Is the kind of decision to foreground them with some of these a cappella moments something that you've recently arrived at? Is it a kind of new confidence, or have you always sung unaccompanied?
No, not always. Only, I think, in the last 3 or 4 years. And the two songs that we chose to unaccompanied on the album, again, The Galway Shawl and The Factory Girl, just deserve that approach. So to dress them up with instrumentation was just simply unnecessary, I feel. They should, if done well, they should stand strong alone, isolated almost. And maybe that's why they're so striking to you.
When you're testing these tracks out, is playing live like an important part of your process and your practice?
Yeah, it is, definitely, because it moves us away from being precious, and that there is a correct way of doing things, that you get to kind of loosely feel things out in a freer way. And that's when happy accidents happen, and little bends and things just get discovered over time. So playing live, and I like to say as well, especially playing live without plugging in, has been really beneficial.
I can imagine, because it seems like one of the difficulties and complexities of working in traditional music, but in new media, quote unquote, you know, making albums and recording them, is that they kind of rely on such an important live tradition that it's almost a contradiction in terms to isolate them in these moments as a CD where the song becomes immutable. But this album carries the immediacy of live music, even in its kind of stasis?
Well, I'm glad that you feel that way. That's what I wanted to achieve. And I don't think it is achievable if we're not working outside the studio in a casual, maybe is the wrong word, but a freer way. Of course, we meet to rehearse and all of that before we go into the studio, but ideally we capture something in a way that you might remember capturing one night in a session, that it just happened and it felt like amongst all the musicians, oh, that was really special, you know. But it's never the same. So we go into the studio, put these things down a couple of times, can't overdo it or something will go missing, you know. And then I guess we have to make a decision and say, okay, the important things, the things that really strike me within versions of that song, we've captured quite a lot in this particular track here, and just have to make a decision then, you know, to put it out there.
Blackbird, sit on my shoulder and tell me some. When I cry, do you hear in color or black and white, bird?
Lisa O'Neill there, talking to Monocle's Augustin Macellari, and Lisa's album, Heard Along On Song, is out now on River Lee Records. She'll be playing shows, including a stop at the Barbican in London, as part of Imagining Ireland, a one-off exploration of contemporary Irish culture on the 30th of January. For more about that and more upcoming dates across Europe, head to lisaoneill.ie. This is the Monocle Weekly. The gallery at the Institute of Physics might not be one you've heard of before, and that's because it's brand new. The charity and publisher IOP, which looks to educate the world about physics, has a new £30 million home in London's King's Cross, not too far from our Monocle HQ. And it's commissioned Irish artist and filmmaker Grace Weir to create the inaugural exhibit.
Weir has enlisted the help of leading physicist David Berman of Queen Mary University in London and Professor Faye Dowker of Imperial College London to create a video installation, Time Tries All Things. Earlier, Monocle Stonehall headed down to the gallery at the Institute of Physics to speak to Grace and learn a bit more. But first, here's a short excerpt of the new work.
Your history accumulates more past events. So you're different now than you were half an hour ago, because more has happened. We experience time passing, and it's probably the most basic aspect of our perception, this temporality of our experience.
The speed of light is not really about something moving. It's almost the opposite. It's about how the causal structure of space changes from future and past.
My mother said apparently when I was 7, I announced I was only happy when I was drawing. So I was always going to be an artist. My father was an artist. I was always drawing. I was always going to be an artist. But physics and maths were my two other favourite subjects at school. And the great divide happens. It happens to everybody. And I think that that's sort of a shame to a certain extent. And I think it took me a long time to come back to my interest in physics. And that came about from making films. Time is intrinsic to filmmaking. So the more I worked in film and photography and those mediums which incorporate time, the more I wanted to understand time better. And that's what led me back to a physicist to ask him about the nature of time, to understand it. I think I'm kind of interested in the elementary. I'm interested in the kind of, for me, it's how do I begin to talk about really anything without understanding the medium in which I am working. So even if that's time and space, so time, space and language. So I'm all the time going back to the elementary, if you will, and to try and investigate that before I can kind of go forward.
I wanted to actually talk about the timing of the piece itself. It's 30 minutes long. There's pauses in there which I can't imagine are accidental. And I just wonder whether you were aware of making the viewer think about time passing itself as the film progresses.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, what interests me about film is that the way it maps the kind of pastness of a recorded event onto the presentness of viewing it. And it's that kind of mapping of one time into another time that really interests me about film. That's what I like about film. I think about film as kind of sculpting in time, which is what Tarkovsky described it as. And I do think of film as it's like carving. You're carving out a kind of space-time continuum for people to view. I mean, it was serendipitous that it was a half an hour long, particularly because Faye actually at the end of her piece says, you're different now than you were half an hour ago because more has happened. But that was actually just a stroke of luck. I asked the editor at the end, how long is it? And I didn't know if it was 25 minutes or 36 minutes, and it was 30 minutes.
Physics itself, it can be a little bit abstract. What's a really simple idea that can make the everyday listener rethink their sense of time a little bit?
Einstein said time is like a river. Sometimes it's broad and slow. Sometimes it's narrow and fast. Rivulets can break off from it and reconnect back, which allows for concepts of time travel. And I think I always liked that one.
We're here at the Institute of Physics, the gallery at the Institute of Physics, which is probably two words that people would not throw together immediately when thinking of physics. Tell us about the space we're in for a second.
Well, I think the Institute were interested in bringing in other disciplines to come into dialogue with the field of physics. So they were moving to this new building and they deliberately kept this huge space to be a gallery for different events and shows and performances and different things to take place. So I think it was to do with public engagement. I think the public are very interested in ideas of physics and it was to kind of allow for that.
And the work that you've got in the gallery space, Time Tries All Things, talk us through that title. What are you alluding to with that work?
Well, the title comes from a proverb which says, time trieth troth. And it was a proverb that I found written on a stone plaque at Queen Mary University when I was researching ideas for this project. The project was looking at ideas about time in physics through the medium of film. So I was interested in kind of ideas about time in film as much as time in physics. I met with quite a number of physicists, but in particular I met with Faye Dowker and David Berman separately, who gave me differing ideas about time, what time was. And I was fascinated by their different concepts of what time was and the way in which they described and spoke about those things. And it was actually while I was talking with David, the first germs of the film started to kind of crystallise and I knew I really wanted to use his voice. So it was a funny film in that the voiceover kind of came first and the visual followed. And it was while I was researching the visual aspect of it that I came across this stone plaque on the side of the clock tower at Queen Mary University. And it was this strange stone carving of a bird flying over a bay with time trieth troth written in the top corner. And the maker is unknown. It was made in around 1890. And I couldn't find out anything about it. It was a strange piece that spoke to me. And I took a photograph of it. I was thinking also about kind of the nature of phone photography, if you like, in that kind of disposable way. We take pictures and we just sort of throw them away. This kind of this high dispersal rate for digital photography. But I still think of photography for me as a kind of marker of time. I still think of it as a moment of time that we try to sort of fix time with photography. And in a way, when I took the photograph of this plaque with time trieth troth written on it, I actually wanted to kind of expand that moment. I actually wanted to kind of make a piece, a film, which opens out that moment, that photographic moment, into a wider consideration of what our notions of the present is. Because basically physics offers us these extraordinary shapes and concepts, and we think about time in an oversimplistic way. And I really learned from talking to both Faye and David that time is not what we think it is. And I think that has implications for a great number of things, including our sense of history.
I wanted to get onto some of these concepts of time, which are in the piece. I mean, it's, as you've said, I mean, we think about time in what you have said is a simplistic way, but we really, in a day-to-day sense, can only really approach it in the sense of reality, the head-on sense of we're moving in some direction, mostly forward, because obviously going backwards is not very possible. What's the use of discussing time in this way? Because there's not a lot we can do about time, is there?
Well, I suppose it's the difference between realising that reality is not necessarily what our perception of it is, that reality is actually quite something different to what our perception as human beings think it is. And I think that that separation, we need to think about that. It's, the world is not necessarily as it seems to us, according to our ability to perceive it. For me, I think we need to radically rethink time. I think that time, if we could change our understanding of time, it might actually transform us. I think it might be transformative. I think it might make us think differently about a lot of things. We used to believe it was a flat earth. I think we're very kind of sophisticated when it comes to space. Like, we understand multi-dimensions, we understand hyperspace. We're kind of relatively at ease with those kind of ideas. And I think that the time aspect we've yet to kind of really get to grips with.
Now, I'm going to try and probably quite clumsily summarise what I took from what the two figures in your film were discussing. And it seems to me, in the most simplest of terms, and please do correct me, that perhaps one of them was arguing that everything in the course of time is fixed. Everything that happened in the past has happened. Everything that will happen in the future will happen. And we are just a little bit powerless in the middle. And that's why we sort of don't have this, obviously, foresight of what's going to happen. We can't comprehend it. So I believe he was saying that everything is kind of in a big box and we'll get to the end of it in some way. And then the counterpoint was that time is not set. It's not set in stone. It's not events that can't be changed, and that experiencing the moment of it is absolutely essential to its outcome. Is that anything close to what they were saying?
Yes, it is. I mean, David Berman was talking about the block universe theory. It's the idea that all events exist already, including future ones. And it's kind of a block universe. It's kind of a continuum through which we are passing. The thing that's really central to that is that the future exists already. Whereas Faye actually thinks that time consists, is discrete. It's not continuous. That time consists of these very small space-time atoms, and that they happen, they are birthed, they are born, but it happens so quickly one after the other that it feels continuous to us. And hers allows for the fact that the future might not exist, does not exist already. So that's a kind of real fundamental difference between them. And that is what Einstein's theory of relativity has given us. And it's verifiable, and it's backed up by probably the vast majority of physicists. Relativity is the greatest paradigm-shifting concept of space and time that we've got. But it's to build on that. It's to change it. What does it mean? It's a really interesting debate, and if you listen to these different physicists, and there's many different theories about time, but it seems to me to come down to that basic thing about whether or not the future exists already or not. I think it's complex enough that it allows for us to, for how we pass through it, for all possibilities. There's the many-world theory. There's lots of different versions of that. But I find these ideas quite fascinating.
You're known for combining art and academia and science and other disciplines such as today physics. People put up walls between those disciplines. As I said at the beginning, people might not expect to find a gallery in a physics institute. Do you think those silos are necessary? I mean, certainly in a sort of scientific clinical way, it's absolutely necessary to be able to categorize different pursuits and different outcomes and things like that. I mean, but obviously it's much more fun when we combine them. I mean, do you think that putting up these walls between disciplines is a useful thing?
I think it's a necessary thing, but I think it's a shame that we don't have more dialogue and discourse. It's not that I think everyone should make these kind of ugly hybrids. I'm an artist. I'm making art. I'm not making science. But I find some of the ideas that I've received from physicists about shapes and concepts have actually influenced my art or influenced my sense of structure. It's really about dialogue and discourse. I think we have to suspend prejudice, and there's an awful lot of prejudice. And I really get tired of these kind of master narratives. You know, an artist is whatever, expressive, and a scientist is rigorous. I mean, I think I'm very rigorous as an artist, and I've met incredibly creative and imaginative scientists. So I think these cliches are these kind of stereotypes, they should be broken down. Those walls should be broken down. It's more about access. I think it's great to get access to other fields. You'd be surprised how much it can influence your own methodologies to actually encounter someone else's. You know, it's an interesting thing to do. So really it's about dialogue and discourse.
And in the film, I wanted to sort of revisit what you were saying there about people saying that maybe an artist wouldn't be rigorous or a scientist wouldn't be, I don't know, emotionally engaged. Because definitely when Faye Dalka seems to be talking sometimes, she seems to be making a point that it's useful or relevant to equate time passing with your own personal experience, and that was one of the sort of maybe the faults she was trying to raise with David's outlook. I mean, is that unusual for a scientific thinker? It's almost a sentimental thought to be sort of saying that your personal experience is absolutely vital to how we understand time. I mean, is that something that you come across regularly, that sort of emotional perhaps input into how we think about science? Is it useful?
There are a lot of serious physicists who agree with Faye, who work with Faye and who Faye works with, who are really seriously addressing this idea about becoming, that we need to kind of incorporate a concept of becoming into relativity. But probably the majority agree probably with David, which comes from relativity. So I think Faye is kind of more unusual, but she's a very serious scientist, and she's got some very serious thinkers working with her. So I don't know what the percentages are, but, you know, I think what I find really interesting about Faye is that Faye is aware of the limitations in the field to explore the ideas, and even in terms of language. In fact, actually, both David and Faye made reference to that. The Faye says that representation is a limitation, that we can't even talk about these things because that somehow puts a certain cast on the things. we're trying to pin down something that's actually fleeting, you know. But David also talks about that. I mean, David talks about the idea that he says our intuition is actually based on our descriptions, that the problem is how we describe time or space starts to really influences how we think about it. So how do we unthink our ideas about time and space without describing them differently? So for me as an artist, it's all about representation. So how do we represent our understanding? How do we convey meaning? And I think that's an issue for both art and science.
The piece, it's a really sort of elegant, graceful way to sort of put these really quite surreal at times ideas to people. Would you see it more as art, or do you try to see something like this as education?
No, it's all art. It's actually entirely factually based, but it's not a documentary, you know. So it's while I am dealing with what we consider the factual, it's a cinematic experience. So it's documentative, but not a documentary.
Again, I mean, I'm wading into theory and stuff, which I really have only the most fingernail grip on. But there's a lot of dialogue in there, which even though it's presented in this sort of quite nice, like, clear, refined way in the film, it's unusual to say the least. It's just where David is saying things like, if you measure the speed of light in meters per second, that number actually means nothing, because if I change the meter or the second, that number changes. So I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, if you can play around with the units and you can play around with our perceptions of what's important, how do you really find the constant of what is important in a debate like this?
Well, I suppose that's the whole point. He's trying to say that these things are arbitrary, that they're things we've set up for ourselves. They're descriptions that we have now that we determine. We say, this is the meter, this is the second. But that could change. In other words, these things are set up to describe the real world, the physical real world, nature. But that's not necessarily what nature is. So I think that's what he's really trying to open up, that we need to look at the models and language we use to describe reality and how much that's influencing our concept of reality, as opposed to what reality actually is.
And prior to this, you've done other projects combining these disciplines. Talk us through maybe a couple of highlights of some of the journeys you've taken to make art that, you know, tells these stories and widens people's perspectives on science and physics and more.
One of the most enjoyable ones I did was I went to Chile, to Cerro Paranal, to the observatories that are up there, to look at the black hole. I wanted to film or photograph the black hole, which is at the centre of our galaxy. And of course, you can't see it because it's black. And I was interested in this kind of, that black holes are one of the last unknowns in physics. They undo our current thinking about space and time. They're a kind of limit in our understanding. And they're also a limit in terms of representation. How do you represent a black hole in a black sky when you can't see it? And we've just gone into blackness, which is very appropriate.
Let me just tell you that for some reason, as soon as Grace mentioned a black hole, all of the lights went out in the theatre we're sitting in, which is really strange. That's probably a great note to end it on, in the pitch black. Grace Weir, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Artist and filmmaker Grace Weir in conversation with Tom Hall there. Grace's work, Time Tries All Things, is on show at the Gallery at the Institute of Physics here in London right through to the end of March. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Well, there you have it, Fernando. That is edition 498 of The Monocle Weekly, and what a show it was. And it was all put together, as ever, with consummate skill by Tom Hall and Augustin Macellari. Our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. We'll be back at the same time next week, but for now, from me, Tom Edwards.
And me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
It's goodbye.
Goodbye.